morning, everyone. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. And Representative Fenton, would you make a motion to approve the minutes, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I make the motion to approve the minutes.
Representative Fenton moves approval of the minutes. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Need at least one. Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Couple ground rules for today. We've got quite a few folks coming up today to introduce themselves, give us brief overviews, asking everyone to please do their best to be succinct. Members, please be brief in your questions when you have them, and folks, be brief in your answers. We have a lot on the schedule today in addition to this committee hearing, so we want to make sure that we stay on track and respect everyone's time. With that, the first group up, we're going to talk pensions here. The Public Employee Retirement Association, the Teachers Retirement Association, Minnesota State Retirement System, and the State Board of Investment. It's my understanding, I think all of you guys are kind of coming up at the same time to kind of give us a brief overview. And so when each of you speaks for the first time, please make sure you introduce yourself for the record. And unfortunately, you have the high challenge of making this fun and entertaining. So,
thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can we steal a chair from either side?
Please.
Do you want us to roll it in? Or?
If the page could help everyone make sure they have a chair.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mary Vanek. I am the current executive director of the Public Employees Retirement Association through Tuesday. So I'm here to give you a brief overview of PERA. I'd also like to, Shana, if you'd stand quickly. Shana Jones is the person on staff who you will be seeing in hearings on pension issues thereafter. PERA covers city, county, and local and school district employees, the non-teachers. We are the largest of the systems in terms of membership and assets. We have about 154,000 active members. We have about 49,000 people who have qualified for benefits and who will receive them when they reach retirement age and apply. And we have over 96,000 benefit recipients as of today. So we reach a lot of people. Our board is made up of 11 members. Five of them are appointed by the governor. One to represent school districts, one to represent cities, one to represent counties, one a public member who is knowledgeable in pension matters, who is a non-public employee, and an individual who is a retiree of our association. We are currently involved in an election. We have five members elected by the membership. Three of them represent our general plan, one retired member is elected, and one police and fire representative specifically from that membership. And then the state auditor is designated in statute to sit on our board of trustees. We currently have assets under management of about $22.7 billion for all the plans that we administer. And if you turn to the third page, I'm focusing just today on our largest plan, the general employees plan, which is most of our public employees in the system. About 140,000 of the members that we cover come from that plan. Another 10,000 come from police officers and firefighters who are full-time, and then we have about 3,500 members who are in local government correctional facilities. So on the chart on page 3, the goldish line is the PERA general plan. We were 78% funded back in 2007, and with the market situation over the next 2 years, we dropped to 54% funded. Significant reforms were enacted by the legislature in 2010 based on board's recommendations to lower benefits and increase contributions and cut the retiree adjustments that we were paying. And with the good market returns and those modifications and benefits, the general plan of PERA has bounced back to 82% funded. These are what we call market value numbers. They are taking the actual assets that we have compared to our liabilities and saying we have 82% of the assets that we need to cover our benefit obligations, and by law we are required to be 100% funded by 2031, and we are on track to do so.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System, so thank you for having us. Actuarial discussions and survivor benefits are always fun and exciting in my life, so thank you for having us here. MSRS covers state employees, U of M non-faculty employees, Met Council employees. The legislators are in, most of you are in our unclassified plan, which is a defined contribution plan. We also have a state patrol plan and a correctional plan. So we cover a lot of different employees and a lot of different plans. We are of the three funds, we are the smallest, and we're proud of that. We have 54,000 active members participating overall, so they are contributing to our plan. We have about 17,000 people who have less state government but someday would be eligible for a pension. They didn't meet the requirements or decided to hold their pension until they got closer to full retirement. We're paying about monthly benefits to about 37,000 people, so each month we're issuing payments to 37,000. Those are our traditional defined benefit plans, most of those. We also administer two defined contribution plans, the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan, which you and all of the employees can participate in. It's the fifth largest deferred comp plan in the country. We've got 80,000 members in that plan. We also administer a healthcare savings plan that's available to all city, county, state, and school district employees. We've got about 90,000 members in that plan. We too have a board that governs us. We are a non-executive branch state agency. So we are state agencies, but we're not part of the executive branch. So therefore, our board is the one that oversees our plan. We have three members appointed by the governor, and then the rest are elected from our membership. So we have an 11-member board total. Again, if you flip to the third page, I won't cover the changes we made, but MSRS, if you can look back at in 2007, we were at 99, or the green line, we were at about 99% funded. When the market crashed in 08 and 09, we fell to 66%, and I'm happy to report that we're now at 92%. Again, that's on a market value. So we've made remarkable coveries based on the bipartisan changes that you enacted in 2010 and again in 2013, plus the market has recovered.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jay Stoffel. I am the Deputy Executive Director at the Teachers Retirement Association. Our Executive Director, Lori Hacking, is busy at a meeting at MMB, so therefore I'm covering the meeting today, so glad to be with you. I understand she's here. Thank you for the time today, Mr. Chair, to present to you. The TRA covers the licensed staff in the schools, so that would be people from teachers, superintendents, counselors, anybody with a teaching license is in our plan. We include all public schools, charter schools, parts of the MinSCU system. Those folks who choose to have TRA coverage, they have some options when they're in their employment in MinSCU. The Minneapolis Teachers was merged in 2006, and the Duluth Teachers is about to complete the merger in 2015, thanks to some good legislation passed last year. So besides the TRA, the only other teacher group that's out there is the St. Paul Teachers. So we're the medium-sized fund of the three in terms of members and assets. We've got 77,000 active members, almost 59,000 retirees, about $20.3 billion in assets. Our board is an 8-member board. It's comprised of 4 active members, 1 retiree. Those 5 are elected by the membership, and then the commissioner of MMB, commissioner of education, Department of Education, and we get a representative from the School Boards Association on our board as well to round out the 8 positions. On page 3 of your document, we are the blue line, so in the middle of the graph. Similar story, we were well-funded before the crash of 2008, went down to as low as 60% funded, but a strong recovery. Also, same story with the recovery of the markets, but the 2010 legislation in our case froze our COLA for 2 years. We raised employee and employer contribution rates, so some legislative action plus some strong market recovery has improved the fund since that time. So I will turn it over to
Okay, good.
Oh, okay. Yes. I will go to page 3. And there's a, I'm sorry, it's the second page. It's a, there's a graphic of a dollar bill on the top of the second page. What we're trying to represent there is the revenue source that we have for managing the pension funds. When you think of a dollar of revenue, 70, over the long term, 71 cents of every dollar that comes in comes from investment return. We also rely on employee and employer contribution rates. Employers put in about 16 cents of every dollar, and employees put in 13 cents of every dollar. But that is to represent the power of pre-funding the pension funds. We take the contributions, we invest the assets through the State Board of Investment, and over the long term, of course, this story isn't true every year. Markets are up and down, of course, as you know. The 71 cents doesn't hold every year. But over the long term, that's the financing mechanism for the pension funds. So we really rely on the market activity, the pre-funding idea. This is not a pay-as-you-go system where the money that's coming in immediately goes out. We have a large reserve of assets to invest and provide for the future. So that's the representation on the top of the page. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mansco.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the opportunity to allow me to tell you a little bit about the State Board of Investment. My name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer of the SBI. I replaced Howard Bicker, long-term serving director, in October of 2013. The State Board of Investment is a creature of the Constitution. Our sole charge is to manage the assets of the state, which are primarily the pension assets and the state treasury. My board is made up of four of the five constitutional officers. The governor sits as chair, and the other three members are the state auditor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. We're assisted by a 17-member investment advisory council. 10 of the members of the council are appointed by the board and have extensive investment and financial experience. The three executive directors of the statewide pension plans are ex officio members. The commissioner of management and budget, or his or her designee, sits as a member. And the governor appoints coterminous with his term two active representatives, participants in the pension plans, and one retiree. We manage in total approximately $80 billion. 60% of that, $6 billion of that, are the pension assets. We also manage the state treasury. We manage a couple of trust funds for the state, the permanent school fund, the assigned risk plan, and the environmental trust funds being the largest. And we also are responsible for the management of several of the state defined contribution plans. For the pension plans, which we're here to talk about today, we manage about $60 billion, and we have an asset allocation which is very focused on the investment in equities. About 60% of our asset allocation are public equities, split 45% to domestic and 15% to international. We manage 20% in fixed income and bonds, and the residual, we have a target of 20% in alternative investments, which for the state board is primarily private equity, some oil and gas partnerships, and real estate. The board for the pension plans have two major objectives. Over a 10-year period, we try to exceed our composite index of the type of funds we manage in. And over a 20-year period, we try to produce a real return. We've been pretty successful over the long term in doing that. We've been fortunate to have some pretty healthy returns. Over the past 30 years, we've been able to generate a return of 10.3%, exceeding our benchmarks by 30 or so basis points. This past year, we were able to produce a return of 18.6%, and through the current fiscal year, we're about 2.5% through the middle of the year. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Thank you all for the information. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions, and I appreciate the content. Mr. Perry, in looking at the page 3,
yes,
I noticed some discontinuity between the returns between 2009 and 2012, in particular that of the performance of the TRA portfolio. And I'm just wondering, is this a reflection of the asset allocation that that portfolio has in comparison to the other two lines on the graph, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Perry?
That's a funding question. All three of the plans have the same asset allocation, and during that time period, it was during and after the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I quite understand that answer, Mr. Perry, in light of the fact that 71 cents out of every dollar is generated by earnings rather than by contributions.
Mr. Stoffel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. What the line graph is displaying is it's the comparison of assets to liabilities. So it's two parts of the equation, not just the asset side. So an important measure that comes into play is the liability side. And those will vary by fund. So when we do our line graph like this, the asset return is identical for the three plans, but the liabilities will vary because of demographics and the membership makeup of the groups. So that's why the numbers will change on this graph. That helps. It's a combination of the assets and the liability.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Perry again, you mentioned, and this is a two-part question, the first part of it goes to, you alluded to a benchmark, a composite benchmark for these as an index. If you could just elaborate in terms of what that benchmark is, and then secondarily with the rate of return that you cited as well, I'm wondering if you, for the committee, could just elaborate in terms of the risk-adjusted beta that the portfolio would be in comparison to the index.
Okay. Mr. Perry.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. The benchmark that I allude to, we compare the total portfolio in each of the asset classes within the portfolio to passive indices. For the domestic equities, we compare it to the Russell 3000, which is a broad U.S. benchmark. To the international, we compare it to the MSCI All Country World Index X the U.S., which is, again, a broad international benchmark. For bonds, we compare it to the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index. For all of our alternative portfolios, we compare them to themselves, so we don't show any beta. We don't show any excess return to those. We just match it. We think that because of the difficulties of having specific benchmarks for alternatives, that's the most appropriate. I would like to tell you that the alternatives that we've invested in have all had pretty attractive returns over the long time period. To answer your second question, don't have the numbers with me at hand, but the beta to the public market assets, stocks and bonds we have, we'd be slightly above 1.0 beta on that because we do have some active management. We've in each case been able over long periods of times to be accretive to what the portfolios would have been had we just managed them strictly to the index.
Representative Albright.
And I'm wondering, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Perry, if to the point of the benchmark, has the benchmark changed in time? And secondarily, I would understand that these portfolios are actively managed as opposed to passive.
Mr. Perry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have a mixture for the stocks and bonds of active, passive, and for lack of a better term, enhanced passive on the both the stock and bond side. So it's a mixture of each type of style.
Representative Albright.
One final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious in terms of, you mentioned some, for lack of a better word, non-public investments that are held within each of the portfolios. Have you found that over the course of the last 5 years, that allocation to those has increased, stayed the same, or upon what basis are you able to evaluate the mark to the market on those investments?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, those assets are marked to market. They're marked every quarter, but they're not. The marking is essentially based on the fair market value assessed by the managers that we invest with. Over the past 5 years, we've had some pretty good returns from those. They've been accretive to the investments that we've had in public markets as well. So for the last 5 years, the returns for our alternatives have been no less than 12.5% and up to 18% in each of the individual years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Just a quick question so I understand. When you talk about the liabilities, could you give me a few examples with, say, TRA, would that be like the age of the pool of the people staying in that profession, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, the liabilities are calculated for each individual member, whether they're active members or retired members. We take the actuarial process takes every member that we have and their age, their marital status, their years of service, their salary. We calculate a liability, do a present value discounting. It's a very complex calculation, but we take all that into effect along with the benefits in the plan. There are various benefits in all the plans. That's, again, why the lines will vary. The lines on that one page will follow a pattern for the most part, but they will deviate because of all these. There are demographic differences, some benefit differences. We have different cost of living arrangements. So those are all the things that go into the actuarial valuation process to calculate the liabilities.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm recollecting that, is it annually that you report what your unfunded liabilities are as a group, and when does that report come out, and how does that look like it'll be this year?
Who'd like to handle that?
So, Mr. Chair, President Runbeck, our actuarial numbers are as of June 30th of 2014. So every June 30th, we recently have those numbers, so we could provide a total of unfunded liability if you would like for all of the plans that we administer.
That would
Representative
be helpful,
Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, and is that something you could do today, or?
Mr. Bertram.
Today, I could give you an example.
Okay.
You can hold on a minute. So in our general plan, for example, our big plan that's 92% funded, we have about $11.5 billion, and we have about $1 billion unfunded liability, just in general terms. So we have $11.5 billion in assets, and our liabilities are 12.4. So that's how we came up with the 92%. So for our biggest plan, our current unfunded liability is 1%. And we could get all of our plans and give you a sheet with all of them if that's helpful. Mm-hmm.
Representative
Runbeck. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would appreciate that very much. Could you comment, I've been trying to understand this area for quite a while, and I mean, do you compare how our state is organized compared to other states? I mean, we have a kind of a unique approach, I think. You don't report really to the governor, I don't think. Could you just describe sort of your organization and who are you responsible to, and you know, who get
Mr. Bergstrom?
How does the legislature actually intervene?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, so we all report to a board of directors. So that is who we report to. We prepare an annual report. We get an actuarial report, which goes to the Pension Commission. So I think you're hearing from the Legislative Commission later. So the Legislative Committee on Pensions and Retirement pay very close attention to our funding and everything else. So we have oversight there. We're audited by the legislative auditor as far as the accuracy of our bookkeeping. They don't look at funding or anything, but they make sure that we're following all of the laws and rules. So the oversight really is with the legislature and the Legislative Commission on Pensions above our board of directors.
Mr.
Representative Runbeck.
A follow-up then. So the Legislative Commission, do they report then to... Well, they report to the legislature.
Right.
Exactly. So.
Right. You have a couple of members on the board.
Right.
Representative Nelson and Representative O'Driscoll are on the board. So, are on the pension commission. Our board doesn't necessarily report to anybody. They file the reports. They do all of the disclosures, but they are our governing entity.
Representative Rumbach.
It just seems very difficult to well, how about this? Across the funds, are there different benefit levels? Are there different methods of computing the retirement? It seems like each one's a little bit different, and it seems like there would be more uniformity in terms of how the different classifications establish their pensions.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, there are differences. The benefits that we pay are all set in statute, so everything that we have is set by law. There are some good reasons for differences. So, for example, we administer our general plan. They have lower benefits than our state patrol plan, for example, who has an age 55 retirement. They do not have Social Security. So each of the plan is more designed to fit the personnel that they have. So our general plan has full retirement at age 66. Our state patrol benefits full retirement at 55. So each plan has an independent sort of benefit structure that is set by the legislature.
Okay. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
One more question. I'm aware that in PERA now there's going to be, and perhaps other funds, but I know for sure, and local governments will be required to actually show their unfunded liabilities for their pensions, and that would be on their balance sheets. Do you take a position that each is going to have a very different situation with unfunded liabilities? Should not that local city be responsible to fund their unfunded liability as opposed to handing it off to the taxpayer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rombeck, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board has set up this new process for acknowledging that the employers contributing to the plan fund the plan along with employee contributions. So the new rules are requiring that we assess, we don't assess the cost, but we determine mm-hmm. what share of our unfunded liability is associated with a particular local unit of government, and that's based on contributions that are contributed by that local unit of government compared to our total contributions that we collect. So we calculate on that percentage. The purpose of it is to then show where that cost may be accounted for in some time in the future. However, we're a cost-sharing plan, and by being a cost-sharing plan, we are able to maintain a level percent of pay across all members of the plan and all employers of the plan, which is a more efficient and effective way of assessing that cost. If you wanted to go to individual plans, we'd revisit local plans that existed for years, the teachers' plans, the police and fire plans, where you have situations where you may end up with more benefit recipients than you have actual workers. And when you do that on a local level, that can be difficult. So our cost-sharing plan across the system that we have currently created is a much more cost-effective plan for local governments in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rumbach.
Pursuing that a little further, so you have, particularly at the local government level, a vast variety of methods by which the pension is established. Very different, I think, levels of pension even. So comparing the city of Duluth, for example, which we know, I guess, has been somewhat irresponsible in terms of, you know, awarding higher pension levels, are you saying that citizens of cities from the rest of us, if they have issues, we are all contributing? Is that really how it works?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbach, specifically with the city of Duluth, we had an issue in recent years where they were reporting compensation that we viewed was not eligible pension contribution, mm-hmm. and that's now been taken through the courts and taken care of. Our laws have been changed to very clearly delineate what we will accept contributions for pension purposes, and all employers have the same set of rules and are being carefully monitored to make sure that they're reporting the salary accurately and are making the same contribution. All members in any city in our plan, their benefits are calculated with the same formula. It's the salary differences that generate a difference in pension payment. So for all intents and purposes, it's a pretty level playing field in terms of how we calculate pensions. Because of some other issues and the salary, the redefinition of salary to make it very clear what we will take contributions on and calculate pensions on, last year the legislature supported us in requiring, for example, employers give us information about overtime so we can assess whether overtime is being used by one community more than another and see if that's impacting across the pension plan as a whole, cost variations, so that we want to make sure that we continue to have this fair distribution of contributions collected and pensions paid. So we have taken measures, the legislature has supported us in continuing to look at those issues and monitor them.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then Representative Rumbach, Mr. Shepard pointed out to your very first question, there's a lot of really good information and to all members on the packet in your folders, the Minnesota Public Pensions Plans, especially page 37 might be a good place to help get you some immediate answers on that. Representative Mullery, then Representative Nelson, and then we'll move on to the next item on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, all my questions were answered in the meantime.
Good man. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I look at this bar chart that we have on page 3 of our handout, if I remember right, in 2012-11, we passed legislation here where we lowered the assumed rate of return on the plans, and that actually made the plans... That's probably where that dip is. I guess I'm looking at this and going, why is it that instead of the other two plans dropping, PARA didn't drop as much? I don't know what the change. It's probably demographics why they didn't go down as bad. But that was the year we lowered the assumed rate of return on our plans, and that actually would make them look like they're less funded than they are, or something more accurately funded, depending on what side of the argument you are with that. But as they've said over many years, they've made over 10% return on the funds, and I think our return, it's 8.5% is what our assumed rate of return is. So, I mean, if you lower that means you've got to put more money in the plans up front to fund them. And the other point is that, was mentioned earlier, the full funding date, this unfunded liability that's there is the funds have basically got a mortgage out there, just like we have a mortgage on our house. And in 2031, that mortgage will be paid off, and they'll be supposed to be fully funded. I think all the plans, I think it's about the same date, if I remember right. And that's all I had.
Excellent. Thank you. Good points. Thank you all very much for your time here today. Pensions are probably one of the most important things that we'll deal with in this committee when the pension bills do come up before us. So thank you. Thank you for your time, Ms. Vanek. Thank you very much for your service. And we look forward to working with all of you and doing the best that we can for our state and our people. So thank you very much. Next on the agenda, we have the Metropolitan Council introduction. Welcome, gentlemen, to the committee. If you could, please state your name for the record, and then we're happy to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Adam Dunnick, the Metropolitan Chair, newly appointed Chair of the Metropolitan Council, and appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I just want to say a few introductory remarks and introduce myself to the committee. I had a great meeting with Chair Sanders yesterday, and I look forward to getting around to meet everyone else on the committee too, individually or whatever, in any format that works best. A little bit of background about myself. I'm a fourth generation come from a construction family out in western Minnesota. I've been working on construction and road and infrastructure issues since a very young age. Grew up out near Wilmer, moved to the Twin Cities just about 10 years ago, and have had a long career in working on public policy issues regarding transit, transportation development, and look forward to utilizing that background in my work on the Met Council. The other thing I just want to make very clear about my role in the council, now that it's a full-time job, I want to be as accessible as possible here in the Capitol to you all, and as well as out in the communities. I plan to kind of split a lot of my time in the coming weeks doing meetings with cities, counties, local units of government, individual legislators, and I really look forward to that dialogue. I know that there's going to be conversations around governance, and I want to express an openness to a conversation about that. That's something that's, if there are opportunities for us to improve governance and responsiveness at the council, I think that that's something that both my background as a council member can inform me in, and I think that it's an important dialogue to have right now in our region. So with that, I have to run to an 11 o'clock meeting back at the office, but Judd will take you through the overview, and I know I'll be back before this committee a number of times, but I really wanted to stop by and say hello.
Well, thank you, Chair Dunnick, for stopping by on behalf of myself and the committee. Congratulations, and we do look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
See you all.
Great. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today, and we were asked to provide a overview of the Met Council, so that's what I'll do. I'll try to be brief. I know that there are a number of additional groups that are on the agenda as well. So I've given you kind of the 30,000-foot overview here, and if we have specific questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, I have staff here with me from each of our divisions that will be able to help. But for just a little bit of a background, the council was created in 1967 to plan for the orderly growth of the seven-county metro area and really to coordinate the delivery of services that couldn't be provided efficiently by any one city or county. And that really goes back to the wastewater system. There were failing septic systems and wastewater systems out in the Lake Minnetonka area. And it was decided that to have a regional service provider take care of that. And that's really one of the impetuses for the council being created. Who we are a 17-member board appointed and serve at the pleasure of the governor. 16 members represent the geographic districts across the region, and the chair serves at large. Just to give you an idea of the size of the council districts, the average district for council member represents about 185,000 people, and by comparison, your house districts are about 40,000 people per district. So, you know, maybe just a little bit more than four times the size of a house district and a little bit more than two times the size of a Senate district. So this is a map of the current council districts and our members. As you'll see, the eighth seat is open, when in fact all of the seats are open. The council terms are coterminous with the governor, so we are now in the process of seating a new council, and the governor has a nominating committee that he appoints, made up of many elected and former elected officials who then review the applications, select persons to interview, and then they make their recommendations to the governor. It should be pointed out that those recommendations are not binding, but for the most part, the governors, going back to at least Ventura, really work with the nominating committee. So now into the council. What I have here is a graphic that shows the three main divisions in the Met Council, and it also highlights the statutory authorities that we operate under. And I plan to walk through these. On transportation, I'll be extremely brief because the Representative Kelly's committee, the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee, is where we will do the bulk of our work on transportation. And under Community Development and Environmental Services is really where government operations falls. So, I would also like to add very briefly that as far as the size of the council and our labor force, we have just over 4,100 employees. Many of them are operators, mechanics. The vast majority come from our transit system. But just for a point of reference, in 2003, we had 3,850 so employees. Right now, we're about 4,100. And that is while we also added the North Star Commuter Rail Line, the Hiawatha Blue Line, and the Central Corridor Green Line. So we the growth in our FTEs has been very modest over that time period. Our operating budget is $936 million for calendar year 2015. As you'll see, 71% of that budget goes towards operations, $160 million of it, or 17%, goes toward debt service, and then $115 million of this year's budget will go to the pass-through programs. So by division, you'll see transportation is about 62% of our operating budget. Community development is about 11%. Environmental services is about 27%, and regional administration is really our central administrative unit that really supports these three divisions. I would also just like to point out that of the $936 million for our annual budget, less than 10% is actually collected through our property tax levy. Of that, 54% is for our transit debt service. We've got parks debt service for bonds that we issue, and then we also have our livable communities programs that we administer and collect those monies through the property tax, and then we have our general purposes levy, which goes to support the community development functions of our work product. This next graphic, we just want to show the going back 10 years over the change in the council's property tax levies compared to inflation, and the council's our property tax levy have grown by 13.3%, where over that point inflation has grown almost 30%. So we're very proud of that, of those numbers. I'm going to talk now about our community development division, and so I'll go into all these in a little bit more detail, but we administer the Land Planning Act. We deliver rental assistance through our Housing and Redevelopment Authority. We implement the Livable Communities Act. We guide the regional parks and open space system. We conduct research to support policymaking, and we also prepare the regional development framework. All of these functions that are listed are all listed in statute as functions that the council has to administer to stay in accordance with the law. Just a brief shot here of our community development pass-through programs. You saw before that our overall community development budget was $107 million. Well, $82 million of that is pass-through money that we provide back out into the region. And you'll see here where our sources are. Many of the federal revenues really come to support our Housing and Redevelopment Authority. The state revenues are for our parks operations, which is money that we pass through to the implementing agencies through lottery in lieu of sales tax and through the general fund. And then you'll see that a portion of that is property tax as well, part of that $80 million. And then here you'll see the uses there on the right-hand side. So the Land Planning Act is, again, a statutory requirement of the council to administer that program. And what it really does is we have a development guide and systems plans for four, three, but we're going to combine transportation, or the legislature actually combined transportation and aviation back in the early 2000-2004 area. So we developed the guides and systems plans for transportation and aviation in the metropolitan area, for water resources, and for the regional parks and open space system. And then the next phase after that is that local governments then prepare their comprehensive plans in order to, in accordance with the Land Planning Act as well, and then they come back to the council where we review for consistency with these regional plans. So this slide here really kind of depicts how that process works, and it's about a 10-year process that we go through every decade. So we are just in the process. We just actually adopted the development guide this last May, and now systems plans and system statements are being prepared, and then they will be issued to cities here in the next year or so. And then by by 2018, the cities will then begin to submit their comprehensive plans. And then whatever is decided as part of those comprehensive plans will then be placed into effect through local zoning. So that is how that process works. Mr. Chair, I'm running through this pretty fast, so if you want to stop and talk about something, just please let me know. But we just have a lot to get through here, so just let me know. The Livable Communities Act grant programs, these, again, were created by the legislature in the mid-90s, and there are three areas that of livable communities funds that we work through. The first is the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, which again supports development and redevelopment that links housing, jobs, services, and demonstrates this efficient and cost-effective use of land and infrastructure. The second one is our Local Housing Incentive Account, which produces and preserves affordable housing choices. And the last one is tax-based revitalization account, which is really greenfield to brownfield cleanup funds that is taken off the top of the fiscal disparities fund. There's $5 million that are taken off the top of that fund annually, and to provide those grants. Many people may not know, but the council does operate a housing and redevelopment authority, and in fact, we operate the largest one in the region. You'll see in that light yellow cream colored area is the area where the council actually runs our HRA. It's over 100 communities in Anoka County, Carver County, and most of suburban Hennepin and Ramsey County. We provide housing for over 6,800 households throughout the region, and for the ninth year consecutive year our Metro HRA has earned the highest possible ranking from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for how we administer that program. So we are very, very proud of that. In 1974, the legislature passed the Metropolitan Parks Act, and the council's role in that is to create the policy plan, which goes back to those previous statutes I talked about. We review and approve master plans for the 10 implementing agencies throughout the region. We prepare a parks capital improvement program, which is what we come to the legislature for when we seek money through bonding for the growth of our park system. We also receive legacy funds as part of that, but we prepare the parks capital improvement program for the 10 implementing agencies, and then we work with them to come forward with a list to the legislature. So for those of you on the bonding committee, we'll be talking about this, but it'll also be part of the discussion on the floor when those bonding bills come forward. The council also issues council-backed bonds as a match to state general obligation bonds, so we're able to actually get a bigger bang for the buck. So whatever the state puts in, the council is able to match a portion of that. We also pass through the operations funding for regional parks, and as I mentioned earlier, those are two state funds, the general fund, and then the lottery in lieu of sales tax, and then most recently, the parks and legacy, the parks and trails funds as part of the legacy amendment. Those are also administered through the council and then passed throughout to the 10 implementing agencies. Here on your right, you'll see the implementing agencies, and the green dots represent the council's regional parks, park reserves, and special recreation features, and the orange or the red dots show the state lands, the state parks, which include the Minnesota Zoo and Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. So the regional parks here in the metro area are really the equivalent of the state parks in greater Minnesota. Another function of the council is our Environmental Services Division, and that division has a number of different functions. The first deals with water supply planning, wastewater, and surface water. So this slide kind of gives you an idea of those three and the statutes that guide our work in those three areas. You'll see Here I have a couple slides that talk specifically about each one of these. First is water supply planning. Minnesota Statute 473-1565 has the county implement and update the regional water supply plan. We've spent a lot of time with this at the legislature recently, and there is a lot of discussion regarding this in the Clean Water Act and the as a part of the legacy funds. So we will continue to have that conversation. We also have a role in surface water quality, and the first point you'll see there is by the federal government, we are the council in our Environmental Services Division is designated as the area-wide water planning agency, and then the work with the local Minnesota statutes really works in accordance with our with the state's share of that. So we work both with federal statute and state statute as we work on our surface water quality. Lastly here, as part of our environmental services, we also run the wastewater utility here in the metropolitan area. And just to give you kind of some context, that our wastewater system, which includes eight different treatment plants, operates over 600 miles of interceptor pipes, which are the pipes that connect to the city pipes, which then come into our system. Those 600 miles of regional sewer pipes collect over 250 million gallons of wastewater daily, which is enormous if you think about it. We provide this service for approximately 2.7 million residents here in the metropolitan area and service 107 communities throughout the region. We're very proud to say that our wastewater treatment plants operate on near-perfect permitting compliance. And six of our eight plants continue to earn the National Association of Clean Water Agencies, which is also known as NACWA, the Platinum Peak Performance Award for going on 5 years in a row for each of them. So we are extremely proud of that. This is a function of the council that people oftentimes don't think about, but it is a huge part of our operation here. Just another graphic to show that we try to keep wastewater rates below the national average. Ours is $255 per year. Then in 2014, this is a 2013 graphic, but in 2014, the national average rose to $457 per household, and ours again was $255. And our charge also includes local charges that the other communities add on to those services. So it's ours is a portion of the $255. Lastly, we have transportation, and as I mentioned, I'll keep this extremely brief since we will be providing this to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee here in the next couple weeks. But the council has two main functions. The first is we serve as the region's Metropolitan Planning Organization, or the MPO, where we perform federal and state mandated planning for highway, transit, airport, freight. You can read it yourself, but the council is required to do that to be compliant with the federal government requirements along those lines. We also allocate federal funds through the Transportation Advisory Board, which is a board set up of 33 members, many of them, more than half, are local elected officials who then make recommendations of how to spend the federal dollars that come through the region. And then the last piece is to ensure public input. So we do that through the TAB as well. Lastly, Mr. Chair and members, we operate the regional transit system. Just again for context, last year we provided almost 100 million rides. The bus system accounts for over 83% of that, and the council provides local bus service, express bus service, light rail, commuter rail, and Metro Mobility Dial-A-Ride. And Metro Mobility is the federally mandated Americans with Disabilities Act service that is for folks with disabilities who have no other way to get around other than to use our service. And so it is mandated, and we provide that, and we're happy to do that. It's very expensive service, and that is, I'm back here. But, Mr. Chair, that is the presentation anyway. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those, and I appreciate the opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Thank you for being quick. Ton of information here. I think I saw most members, but all the slides are in your packets. So thank you for that. I do have a couple member questions. If we could keep questions and comments succinct, that would be helpful. But Representative Nash, you're up first.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Shetland, question for you regarding your calendar year 2015 operating budget of $963 million. You said 71% of that is for operations. Could you detail for us or provide detail on what percentage of that is salary?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to do that. I actually I grabbed this slide to come up right before to discuss this. I'll provide this to the committee earlier or after this hearing. What it does is breaks down the sources of funds, but it doesn't go into salary, so I'd be happy to provide that to you and the committee here. I'll send an email around to everyone this afternoon detailing that for you, if that's okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Shetland. Representative Nash.
No further questions.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetland, could you just clarify for me, CTIB, do they have any reporting relationship to the Met Council, or are they simply another agency that directs funds to you?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, CTIB is their own entity made up of five of the seven counties in the metro area that in 2008 banded together and received the authority to levy a local option sales tax for transitway development and for transitway operations. So they work through the council in the transportation area by providing a portion of the state share, or a portion of the local share of large transitways. And then once those transitways are built, they provide 50% of the operating funds for those transitways. Other than that, they do not have a, the council has no oversight over CTIB, but we are actually a member of the CTIB board, and that is through statute.
And Representative
Chair,
Runbeck.
Just a quick follow-up then. In your 2015 budget, what, you know, of the revenue, how much does CTIB account for? Is that
Mr.
somewhat
Shetland.
Static number, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, that number is it will grow this year because we are at, well, it grows as our transitway system grows. And so with the Green Line coming on in for a full year of operations in 2015, the CTIB share will be higher than the half-year share they paid in 2014 because the Green Line opened in June of 2014. And so as transitways are added, their share for operations will grow with those transitways that are developed. So it's not static. It actually grows with the growth of the system. And just to clear up any confusion regarding that, in 2011, during the budget, deal, there was an agreement that CTIB would pay, instead of 50% of the operating funds for the transitways, that they would pay 75%, and then it went back to 50% when we negotiated the 2013 budget.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first, I just have a comment, and it goes to your slide on the change in council property tax values.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if the Met Council would also provide the committee with this same slide, but the addition of a few other benchmarks, and I'll just highlight those, and you might want to write them down.
Yep.
If you could also denote the rate of increase that the council's tax levy has compared to property tax or property rates, land values, the state GDP, or population growth. I'd be curious to see where the harmony is in some of those indices that would, as it would compare to not just inflation, but in comparison to some real-world indexes that, you know, might have more relevance for discussion later in this committee. And then as it would pertain to, Mr. Chair, I'm getting my question, thank you, on your last slide with regard to regional transit operations, you highlight for the provision of bus routes, express bus ridership, that type of thing. I'm wondering if you could also then compare and get back to the committee on to what percent or dollar value of your annual budget is requested, and in of your budget, where in those same categories is your emphasis made?
Mr. Shetland.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, we'd be happy to do that. I know I've got our financial folks here that are taking notes on your first request, and then I will work with our transit staff in order to answer your other questions. I may follow up with you just to make sure I've got it right, but we're happy to provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Shetland, one more question. When I served previously as a mayor in a metro city, we had the levy limits. Can you detail for us the council's levy limit relationship to what we would have had as a municipality?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I'll be happy to do that. I'll send that along this afternoon with the information, but I can tell you right off the top that our general purposes levy, we are allowed to levy the $14.5 million that I mentioned earlier, and we are at the top of that levy. We've got the highway right-of-way levy, where we are allowed to levy about $3.9 million. We haven't levied for that, so we are way below that. For the livable communities levies, we are at 11.34 million, and that is at the top of that levy. And for the tax-based revitalization, which is the $5 million that comes off the top of the fiscal disparities, we are at $5 million, and we've been there for, as far as I can remember, back 10-15 years. But I'll provide that. I'll send that around, that information, with the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Appreciate you coming before the committee today. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda, we have the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement introduction. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For introductions, I'm Larry Martin. I'm the director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rachel Thurlow, and I'm the new deputy director of the Pensions Commission.
Excellent. Welcome.
Members, we're the Pension Commission is part of the legislative branch, which you're getting a double dose of pensions today, and we're sandwiched in between something unrelated to pensions, largely. The Met Council. Mr. Bergstrom from the State Retirement System noted, they're a non-executive agency. The State Board of Investment is a state department. We're part of the legislative branch. We're one of the joint entities, one of the joint agencies under the general rubric of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Perhaps the only joint agency that spends a lot of time with your committee. And we've been around since 1955 as an interim commission, 67 as a permanent commission of the legislature. I put together a large packet for you. I'm doing a presentation to the Senate. I took the sort of materials that I would normally provide for overviews and gave both bodies the same piece of information. So you've got a fair chunk of generalized information on both the Pension Commission and the nature of our public pension plans. I've organized it looking at essentially the questions I think that legislators might well think about or ask when you discover that you have some connection with regulating or legislating on public pension issues. Why is pensions an item that the legislature gets involved with? How does the legislature deal with pension legislation? What do our pension plans look like? How are they constituted? What shape are they in from a pension funding standpoint? And then what issues are likely to roll through in the 2015 session? I'm not going to go through this in any detail, perhaps other than to give you I'll answer the first couple of questions and jump to item five, what might be coming up. The reason why the legislature gets involved in public employee pensions is Minnesota, like most states, has the body of the, or most of the regulation, most of the benefit provisions for their various public pension plans in statute. That's Wisconsin is the same way, South Dakota is the same way, Pennsylvania, where I spent some time with that pension commission, is the same way. So there's an awful lot of pension legislation solely because all the benefit plans are set forth in statute, and virtually any change requires a piece of legislation. How does the legislature in Minnesota handle public employee pension questions? Primarily, having two standing committees which are charged or have jurisdiction over public pensions, your committee and the State Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee in the Senate. Historically, if you go back far enough, each GovOp committee had a pension subcommittee, and the pension subcommittee membership was coterminous or coincidental with the membership of the pension commission for a large number of years in the 70s and 80s. That's not the case anymore. There are no pension subcommittees typically, and the pension commission is drawn from the membership of the legislature at large, not of just this committee and the comparable committee in the Senate. The pension commission, however, functions as if it were the joint subcommittees of pensions of these two bodies. We tend to use or generally use conference committee type rules, so any piece of legislation gets recommended by the pension commission has to have a majority of each body vote in favor. So with a 14-member commission, seven senators and one House member cannot commit the pension commission. It has to be at least four of each body recommending a piece of legislation. We hear by broad agreement or general practice, your committee doesn't hear pension legislation until it's been reviewed by the pension commission, although you're not bound to decline to hear a bill. That's been the general practice. For the past decade and a half or more, the recommendations of the pension commission have been made to you not individual bill, but by gathering up and aggregating all of the pension legislation that is acted upon favorably by the pension commission into one or a small number of omnibus bills. We would split it only if there were a lot of fiscal issues separate from policy issues, just to make life simpler for the legislature handling it. And then we would provide that as an amendment to one of the pension bills as a vehicle bill, and it typically occurs towards the end of your bill hearing period. The pension commission, under the joint rules, is granted some dispensation. Does not have to observe the first deadline, the deadline for getting the pension bills out, typically because the pension commission is appointed later than standing committees and frequently has newer members. There's a little more allowance for time. So the pension commission does the initial screening of pension legislation. It's presented to you in an omnibus pension bill. It then goes to the budget committees, or doesn't go to the budget committees, depending upon the nature of the benefit changes or whatever in the bills. The information on Minnesota public pension plans is set forth starting on page 18 or 19, I guess. It tells you something about how we got started in this business and what the general nature of our plans are. We have both defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans in the state of Minnesota. There's a breakout of that. If you look on page 28 of the handout, I've given you a list of the defined benefit plans on 28 and a list of the defined contribution plans in the state on 29. There's the statutory references in the year that they were created, so if you're interested in seeing what they look like, you can go to the relevant statutes. Minnesota public pension plans have been funded on an actuarial basis since the 1957 was the first set of comprehensive actuarial evaluations for the various pension plans. Anything before that would have been fairly spotty with respect to actuarial work, and it's annual actuarial work provided now. In the, as you noted earlier, we've given you summaries or boil down of the actuarial valuations as part of this part of the presentation. The page 36, I believe, gives you the what the situation is statewide. This is grouping all the various pension plans by a type and giving you a grand total at the end. You're going to find that the numbers here differ slightly from the numbers, somewhat from the numbers that the pension plans gave you. They were pointing out to you that they were using market value of assets. State law provides that market value of assets is used for some purposes, but that there is an actuarial value of assets that's used for actuarial reporting purposes. There's a smoothing calculation that's made. It's basically a five-year smoothing of the assets. So it deviates a bit from market. It's drawn from market, but what it tends to do is to delay the recognition of either gains or losses over a period of time, as every averaging period does. So the numbers you see here are the official numbers as required by statute, but it's not market value. And then jumping to the last item, if you go to the final page, the issues that are likely to come before the Pension Commission and before this committee, either this session or probably the course of this biennium, there's a question of the appropriate interest rate assumption to be used for our public employee pension plans. That was a topic of the 2011-2012 session and appears to be coming back again. The question of the appropriate way to provide pension benefits, be it defined benefit or defined contribution plans, is a recurring issue before the Pension Commission, is likely to be dealt with again this year. Revising the triggers for post-retirement increases. In 2010, the post-retirement increases were generally lowered, and they are restored to the pre-2010 level when certain funding requirements are met, and those triggers are likely to be revised to address some operational problems in them. There are contribution deficiencies in several of our plans, and some of them are larger than are optimal. So that presumably will be addressed at some point. The MRF, the former MRF plan, which was taken over administratively, consolidated administratively by PERA in 2010, had a provision in that 2010 law that it merged with PERA General whenever it reached 80% funded. That occurred with this set of valuations, so there is going to be some spin-off legislation related to folding MRF into PERA General. One of those questions is the state aid and contribution levels. MRF is in relatively good shape. The current contribution amounts, both from the state and from the localities, is larger than what would be needed minimally. So there's some question about whether that's going to be modified, and and how that any savings is going to be allocated. Question of the St. Paul teachers: it's the remaining local general employee pension plan in the state. The balance of our general pension plans, other than volunteer fire plans, are all statewide plans, and so there's what extent we're going to continue having local pension plans. The state provides a large number of state aids that are related to pensions, and some of those are in the jurisdiction of the State Government Finance Division in the House, and some of them are in the tax Committee, but the amount of aids and how they're allocated is always a question. We have a statewide volunteer fire plan that was set up in 2009. It's limited at the moment to lump sum plans. There is some sentiment to expand the coverage of that statewide volunteer plan to also permit on a voluntary basis that that monthly benefits volunteer fire plans can join. Most of our volunteer fire plans provide a lump sum benefit, a single payment. About slightly more than two dozen plans provide for monthly benefits, and there's a question of what to do with those. They're much more complex pension plans, and perhaps too complex or to be run out of a shoebox. Fire department by fire department. And then the demographic question: the baby boom is working its way through our retirement plans, and to what extent the enhanced number of our retirements that's likely to occur in the near term will be handled. So this is our assessment of what some of the things that might be coming your way in a couple of months. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I've given you a sense of what's in this large package of paper, and the Pension Commission for 2015-2016 has not yet been appointed. We're awaiting that, and I'm sure that the members are more than happy to get going. There's going to be a fair amount of education needed for the new commission, because there'd likely be a fair number of members without prior Pension Commission experience from the House. So we're anxious to help you out. We're located in this building. We're in 55 State Office Building. I think on page 12. Yes, page 12 is the membership of the 2013-2014 Commission. The office for the Pension Commission, the staff, it's 3.5 full-time equivalents. We do have an actuary who works over reviews and in some cases replicates the actuarial valuations of the various plans annually to make sure that they're being prepared according to statutory requirements. And that's the Deloitte consulting arm here in Minneapolis. So that, members, I'm happy to answer questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Martin, and thank you very much for this packet. It's a phenomenal asset for us, so thank you for all the information in there. Looks like we have a couple of brief member questions. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, could you comment on the status of the other retiree health benefits, health benefits in general, for retirees, because, nationwide, there's about a 3-to-1 ratio of unfunded liabilities to the pension liabilities for the health benefits. How does Minnesota look, and what should we be doing?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative, that's really out of my bailiwick. We do the pension plans. The pension plans do not provide the health benefits for our retirees. Those are negotiated employer by employer. So it's not something that I have any particular understanding of, and I can't provide you any sense of how the numbers go. The state auditor shop can do it for local government, and the legislative auditor can do it for state government, but unfortunately it's not something that is within the purview of the Pension Commission, and I can't really help you.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Martin, I would just ask you to introduce the person sitting next to you that doesn't look like Ed Burrick, who recently retired.
Yes, we have a changeover.
Mr. Martin. Yep.
In staffing, my 25-year deputy retired in November, and we're happy to bring on Ms. Thurlow as the new deputy, and she has a steep learning curve, but she's doing well.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mr. Martin and Ms. Thurlow. We appreciate your time and all the information, and again, thank you for the packet of information. Thank you. Last on the agenda, we're looking forward to an introduction from the League of Minnesota Cities. Ms. Lindstrom, welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ann Lindstrom. I'm an Intergovernmental Relations Representative for the League of Minnesota Cities.
Thank you for the chance to give you a quick overview of the league. I know some of you are more familiar with us than others. My intent today is to give you enough information to know how we can be a resource to you, and if you have questions that we don't have a chance to get to today, we're more than happy to follow up. So you should have slides in your packet. First things first, the league is a membership organization that is 100 years old. We celebrated our 100th birthday in 2013. We were originally founded in 1974 by the Minnesota Legislature, and until 1974, excuse me, we operated as a part of the University of Minnesota's Extension Services. We're now an independent organization. We represent all cities. 831 of Minnesota's 852 cities are our members. So just to give you a little bit of context, I have a slide on the population breakdown. I think it's helpful to see that 625 cities have a population of less than 2,500. So our membership includes the smallest city of Funkley, Minnesota, that has five, up to the city of Minneapolis, which is obviously the largest city in the state. Related to population is the breakdown of city classification, which is set in Minnesota Statute 410. And I think that this is helpful because there are legislation is sometimes crafted that impacts cities based on their population and broken down by their class. So as you can see, first class cities are more than 100,000, second class are 20,000 to 100,000, third is 10,000 to 20, and fourth is no more than 10,000. So you can see that the majority of cities in the state of Minnesota are fourth class cities. As an example of this, I cover elections legislation, so oftentimes my examples are in that arena. For statutory cities, the filing fees to run for office are set in state statute and they are broken down by class. So, for instance, a first class city, it costs $20 to file to run for office. For second and third, it's $5, and for a fourth class city, it's $2. So that's one example of how, there are many, many more, but that's just one about how it can be broken down. So the next slide is statutory and charter cities, and this information is actually in a House information brief that was prepared by Deb Dyson, is very helpful, from 2011. So you will hear us talking about statutory cities and charter cities. So within each class, a city may be a statutory city, so they are operated and governed by state statute, and for charter cities, they are organized and operated by the charter that's approved by the voters of the city. So I think this chart is helpful in seeing that all of our first class cities are charter cities. And then if you look down and see under the column, the statutory city, 700 of the statutory cities are fourth class cities. So again, the bulk of our cities are fourth class cities and are statutory cities. Again, the major difference between the cities is the kind of enabling legislation from which they gain their authority. So the distinction is not about size or place, location, but it's about where they get their authority. And many of you have a combination. I know a few of you represent one charter city, you represent a statutory city, or you have a combination within your districts. Okay, so back to a little bit more about what the League of Minnesota Cities offers our members for our services. We have an insurance trust, so we provide property casualty coverage for cities as well as workers' compensation coverage. You don't have to buy insurance as a member, but you have to be a member to purchase the insurance. We have a research department, which our cities use extensively. I think last year we had 6,000 inquiries alone to our research department. We as lobbyists use our research department a ton. It's staffed by attorneys, and they will get calls from cities on a variety of issues from, you know, there's been a lot of talk about regulation of electronic cigarettes. So if a city wanted to ban use of electronic cigarettes in public spaces, they would contact our research department and say, do you have a model ordinance that we can use? Or rules for open meeting law, data practices, et cetera. We have an amicus program. So one of our staff members, if there is a case that is going before the courts and could have a significant impact on the operation of cities, we will often file an amicus brief with our opinion about the potential outcome of the case. We have training. Some of you around the table have participated in the trainings that the League of Minnesota Cities offers, including newly elected conferences. We also do loss control training across the state as part of our insurance trust. We have conferences. We have a pretty large annual conference, and we have regional meetings, and for those of us who are extremely extroverted, this is one of our favorite parts of getting to work at the league, is that we go out around the state and meet with our city officials and talk about the different issues that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Our human resources department also does a ton of technical assistance to our cities, which again, I'll refer you back to the different sizes. Our smaller cities don't often have a lot of resources to deal with more maybe complicated human resources employment issues. So we field a lot of phone calls. We have a forum investment services where cities can take distributions of tax dollars and invest them in safe investment vehicles that are pooled together to provide a higher rate of return. And then we have policy analysis, which those folks work to identify the emerging trends. They also produce our State of the Cities report. They also respond to emails like I sent them for this presentation, asking for breakdowns of populations and things like that. What I want to leave you with as far as that goes is that anytime you have legislation, or even if it isn't related to legislation, you are curious about any statistics related to cities, just know that that's the type of information that we would like to provide you as needed. So one of the last slides are legislative issues. So we have a policy development process where we have four different committees that are comprised of over 150 city officials, both appointed and elected, that come together in the summer and the fall and work on our policies that for all intents and purposes are our legislative platform, which is not to say we lobby on all of them, but they give us a foundation for the work that we do. They bring forward the issues that they have been working on, and we essentially brainstorm what would be the best way to address those issues. That could be a legislative change. It could be a rule change. Sometimes it's working with the State Department, and we are often the liaisons between our cities and state departments to deal with the issues that they have. Those policies go to our broader membership for feedback and comment, and then all of that is approved by our board of directors. And as you know, cities are creatures of the state, so pretty much everything that cities do can be impacted by what you all are doing here at the Capitol, which is why we're here on a regular basis to talk about those issues with you. So again, if you're ever considering a bill and would like any information, that's what we're here for. The other thing, the point that I wanted to make, is that when you see one of us that would like to meet with you on something, maybe we send a note to you in on the floor, there's a really good chance that we have already talked with some of your city staff about it. I think that's one of our goals, is to make sure that we know how the cities in your district feel about the legislation that could be moving through that either we're pushing or somebody else might be pushing, to give you a little bit more of a perspective about how it will impact the cities within your district. So the last slide is just a picture of our lobbying staff. It's not your responsibility to know what we cover, it's ours. So if there's any questions, just pick one of us and shoot us an email, and we'll make sure that we get the appropriate staff person to contact you in response. With that, I can take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lindstrom. We have Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lindstrom, as somebody who was a mayor just a few short weeks ago, I'll just say thank you for the resources that you do provide, and would encourage any member of the committee to do reach out, because they are a very good resource, not just on city-related issues, but on the LMCIT as well. Very, very helpful.
Representative Joachim.
Representative Nash beat me to the punch. I was going to say exactly that. If there's any issues, any bills that are coming before you that have to do with cities, or if you're working on something that might affect a city, they're a wonderful resource. So
thank you. Mr. Chair, I promise this I didn't plant these responses from people.
On that note, well, thank you very much for your time before the committee. We appreciate you being a resource to us. Members, any final questions? Comments? Nope. Seeing none, we will stand adjourned. Everyone have a good weekend.